From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, time is running out for death row inmate Joseph Garcia.
I want to live. I want to live, but I'm also tired. I've been fighting a long time, David.
How Garcia was condemned to die in Texas under the rule of parties.
You want to kill me for the actions of somebody else. Why should I die?
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Joseph Garcia sits on Texas death row after he was convicted of the murder of Irving police officer Aubrey Hawkins. But Garcia says he didn't do it.
I don't understand why I'm on death row. I mean, even the DA said it himself, you know, Toby Shook. He said, hey, listen, you know, we can't prove Mr. Garcia shot any of the weapons that night. So if you can't prove that, then what am I here? Why am I on death row? You know, I don't get it. What makes me death eligible? Or why are you trying to kill me for the actions of somebody else? And you have the testimony of these people who did actually kill. They told you they did it. And so, I mean, I think what it all boils down to, David, is that I'm one of the Texas Seven.
It was on December 13th in the year 2000 that the Texas Seven escaped from the Connolly Unit, a maximum security prison in Karnes County. The Seven were led by George Rivas, and using cunning guile and military precision, they were able to drive out of that prison before any of the guards realized what was happening. The escape resulted in the largest manhunt in Texas history, yet for over a month, the Texas Seven managed to avoid recapture. 11 days after the escape, on Christmas Eve, the Texas Seven resurfaced at a robbery at a sporting goods store in Irving, Texas. Disguised as security guards, they overpowered and tied up the employees, and as they were preparing to leave with over 40 guns, Officer Hawkins showed up. He was responding to a report of suspicious activity. The escaped inmates opened fire. He was hit 11 times, and then he was run over as the Texas Seven escaped again. Garcia was there for that robbery, but he says he was still in the store at the time of the shooting. He says he didn't shoot Hawkins, but under the Texas law of parties, it's as if he did.
The law of parties is a difficult issue. I mean, for most people who don't understand it, I think it's a corrupt and unjust system in which where the law provides the state to prosecute and actually find somebody guilty of other people's actions.
I spoke with Garcia on death row in Livingston, Texas, which is outside of Huntsville, and where he is scheduled to be transported and executed on December the 4th. We talked about his life, growing up with a heroin-addicted mother, the knife fight murder that he committed that put him in prison to begin with, his public defender attorney that he says failed to do his job in court, and we talked about how he is dealing with the very real possibility that he will be executed in just a few days. But first, the chief of the Irving Police Department, Jeff Spivey, remembers his fallen fellow officer, Aubrey Hawkins.
He was very nice. Easy to get along with, very unassuming. I think I even heard some people call him, because he was a rather large guy, really tall and stocky, as a gentle giant. So
the departments that you oversee have made a point of making sure that these executions of the Texas Seven, that y'all play a role in that?
I'm not sure what you mean by play a role. We typically have taken a contingent of police officers down to Huntsville to stay outside the unit just as a show of support for Officer Hawkins and his family. Not only did it affect personal family, it affected his work family as well. Many of the officers that are here today were involved in that call, as you might imagine. A call such as that on Christmas Eve required a great deal of resources from our agency, from detectives to SWAT teams to patrol officers on Christmas Eve, away from their families. There was a lot of emotion involved in that. And so those employees that are still here and those retirees who were here at the time that can try to make it a point to be in Huntsville during those executions, just as a show of support for both his police and his real family, and you know, just to ensure that he isn't forgotten, and that the loss that his family suffered and that we suffered isn't forgotten and wasn't in vain. That the fact that justice is being carried out, you know, is somewhat cathartic.
Joseph Garcia says he wasn't there during the gunfire. He was on the loading dock dealing with the tied up prisoners or the hostages. He says this makes him, in his mind, not culpable, that he was convicted under the law of parties, and that somehow he doesn't think that it's justice that he is executed for a crime that he didn't pull the trigger on. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think the evidence shows otherwise, or it would have been brought out in court. The evidence clearly indicated that when the shooting occurred, that at least five of the six escapees were either in the parking lot or around the Explorer. Joseph Garcia, due to his accomplice's testimony, is either credited with pulling Officer Hawkins' dead body out of the car and moving the car, or at least being there when his dead body was pulled out of the car and then moved the squad car so that they could then escape in the Ford Explorer. So I think it's a little self-serving for Joseph to say that, you know, he wasn't around when that happened. The evidence indicates otherwise.
That was Jeff Spivey, the chief of the Irving Police Department. Members of the Irving Police Force are planning to be in Huntsville on December 4th in honor of Officer Aubrey Hawkins during the expected execution of Joseph Garcia. Texas has executed over 550 people since 1982. Three have been given lethal injection under the law of parties, and six men sit on death row today under that controversial rule. Stephanie Stevens is a law professor and supervising attorney for the St. Mary's University Center for Legal and Social Justice.
If you and another person were going to go rob a convenience store, so the two of you set off, you are the driver, and your partner gets out, runs inside with the gun, and plans to rob the store, you're just as guilty for the robbery, even though you're the getaway driver. But also, if during the course of that robbery, your friend inside the store shot and killed the convenience store clerk, you would be guilty for capital murder as well, even though you sat in the car the whole time. The idea being that it's, of course, foreseeable that somebody going into a convenience store with a gun, that something like that could happen, and you're participation in that as a party makes you just as culpable under the law in Texas.
Stevens explains that use of the law of parties in Texas capital punishment cases has made it controversial.
There are not a lot of other states that have this, and it's come to light more in terms of the death penalty. When we see the ultimate penalty being used against someone who didn't even take a life, someone who committed a wrong, participated, but weren't the one who caused the death, to take that person's life simply because they were a party to it, seems to be an extreme punishment.
But while many make an argument against the law of parties for capital punishment, with examples centering on getaway drivers or lookouts who got caught up in a robbery that turned into a murder, for Joseph Garcia, that's not what happened. In his case, he was an escaped prisoner who'd been previously convicted of murder, who was part of a crew that was stealing an arsenal of guns and killed a police officer on Christmas Eve. Robert Dunham is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. He says in cases like this, it can be difficult not to be emotionally swept up into the facts of the crime, but that is why we have a system of laws.
There's a legal saying that bad cases make bad law. And what we want our courts to do is to apply the law dispassionately, to take a look at the legal issues, and to ensure that if we're going to be carrying out the ultimate legal sanction, we do so in accordance with the law. That means you have to respect the Constitution no matter how emotional the facts of a case may be. And just because something terrible happened doesn't mean that a particular defendant is the one who did it. And just because something terrible happened doesn't mean that a particular defendant should be sentenced to death. So the courts need to be careful when they take a look at the actual issues in the case that the law was followed and not get swept up in emotional or political considerations.
Dunham says there are questions if the use of law of parties is even constitutional.
Whether the law of parties is constitutional may depend on the facts of the case. Many states allow vicarious liability. Many states hold people responsible for the acts of others. Many states hold people responsible in certain circumstances for the intent of others. Just because a person did not themselves commit the killing doesn't necessarily mean that subjecting him or her to the death penalty is unconstitutional. There are a bunch of factual issues that are involved. But in a law of parties case, in a law of parties state like Texas, there are very subtle ways in which the law affects the jury's judgment. The jury is told that somebody is criminally liable for the acts and the intent of another person. And so you can't tell by the jury's verdict whether they found that the defendant had exhibited reckless disregard for human life. And you can't tell from the jury's verdict whether they decided that the defendant was a major participant in the underlying felony. So when it comes to Texas and the law of parties, there are factual issues about whether the death penalty is unconstitutional as applied in the case, but there are also legal issues because of the way in which the jury was instructed.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Before Joseph Garcia was a member of the notorious escaped prison crew, the Texas Seven, he was a kid growing up in San Antonio, nicknamed George after Curious George. He was raised by his heroin-addicted mother, who neglected him and frequently abandoned him on the streets. He was expected to help his mother hide from the police when they came looking for her and then lied to them. And as a child, he was close to and was the primary caregiver for his younger stepsister, Arlene, who died of cancer. Garcia served in the Coast Guard with an honorable discharge. He says his ambition was to be a law officer, but that dream would never be reached due to one night in 1996. At that time, Garcia had a job as a maintenance worker at the San Antonio airport, and that night he went out to party with a friend. But events went terribly wrong when they met up with Miguel Luna. Garcia and Luna got into a fight, and Garcia said he was forced to use his butterfly knife to stab Luna to death. Garcia was found guilty of murder and given a 50-year sentence. He was sent to the Connolly Unit and eventually joined the Texas Seven. Garcia maintains he didn't shoot Officer Aubrey Hawkins, but he was there as a member of the Texas Seven on that Christmas Eve during the robbery. And during our death row interview, I asked Garcia to explain what happened that night. And please note, this is a graphic and violent account of the events of that night.
I had an earpiece, and so I was able to hear George Rivas tell me, get out of the store. And at this time, I was overlooking Newberry, who was tying the hostages up. I told him to get out, get that bag, and let's go. As I'm backing out of the break room, that's when I started hearing the gunfire. And I thought it was in the store, David. I thought it was, you know, that's how loud it was, and that's how fast it was going. I was like, oh, my God, you know. You know, of course, the first thing I did was I hunched down, you know. I panicked, and I'm like, oh, man, you know. And there was a lull. There was a little lull, and so I got up. I looked around. I didn't see anybody in the store at all. But I heard some more firing off to my left. And so I ran from that corner to the fire escape door, and I could see Larry Harper. He's standing outside the door, and he's got his arm extended around, and he's firing aimlessly. He's just firing. I grab him, I break his arm. I said, man, what are you doing? What are you doing? He's panicked. He's like, man, they're here. I said, what are you doing, Larry? What are you firing your gun for? He goes, man, I said, man, put that away and grab that bag. And I looked, and I could see half of the police officer's car on the back dock. So I walked down the stairs and I could see Randy running across the street, and he's hopping on one leg. He's saying, "Mom, my foot, my foot." And so I'm yelling at him, saying, "Matt, Randy, where are you going?" He's going off the dock, he's running into the street, and I tell him to get back into the car, and Michael Rodriguez, he's walking in front of me. He's walking from the Ford Explorer towards the car, the police car, and I hear George at the same time saying, "I'm hit." And I'm going, "What?" So I run over to George. George is sitting in the seat. He's got one hand on his stomach like this, and I tell him, "Well, are you okay? What's going on?" And he shows me his hand. He's got blood all on his hand. And I'm saying, "Oh, my God." So when I'm looking at him, I hear some more gunshots, and I turn away, because at that same moment, the police car rams the back of the Ford Explorer. I jump out the way, and I look back, and I can see Michael. He's got the police car's door open, and he's reaching in, and he's trying to yank Aubrey Hawkins out of the vehicle. But he's not coming. He's not moving. I tell George, I said, "Man, can you drive?" And he was like, "Yeah, I can drive." I said, "Well, hold on." And so I run over to Michael and I grab Michael and, "Michael, what are you doing?" He won't come out. He's looking over his shoulder at me. And he's "He won't come out. He won't come out." And I said, "Michael, he's got a seatbelt on." So he undoes the seatbelt, pulls him out. And so what I do, I jump in the car, I put it in reverse, and I start backing it up, because the cop car is behind us and there's the only way out. So as I'm backing it up, So when Newberry saw the officer's car backing up, he thought it was the officer, and he shot around Randy, shooting out the passenger window, shooting at me. I jump out the car. He's got the window, he blew out the whole window, and I'm looking at him. I'm going, you know, of course I'm cussing at him now. You know, I'm telling him, you know, "Hey, what the F? What are you freaking doing?" I could see, he's surprised. He sees that it's me. So George, he pulls out into the driveway. I didn't know that Michael hadn't pulled the officer out far enough. He only pulled him out so much, but when George was backing up, he accidentally, you know, ran him over. I don't know, David. I don't know what caused them to start firing on the officer. By the time I got out there on the back dock, it was over. You know, I mean, even the guys even shot at me.
All that was going on, and y'all just drove out of Dallas, and did y'all know where y'all were going?
No. I mean, first we had to, we got two guys that are wounded, you know, so we tried it. We sewed up George as much as we could. Randy couldn't. He got shot in the foot. There was really nothing we can do, and we've realized that, you know, we're on TV. They got all our pictures on TV, and we know it's a manhunt, and we just like, man, we need to get out of Dallas. And so as soon as we got all the guys dressed up, fixed up as good as we could, yeah, we packed up everything and left, and we just went straight north. And after that, we drove from there through New Mexico and up into Colorado.
And y'all were just go.
Yeah, just go, just try to get as far as we could, you know. I mean, we drove all night long. We stopped for that one rest stop. We got it maybe 3 or 4 hours of sleep, and then the next morning we got back on the highway and just kept driving until we got to Pueblo, Colorado, and that's where we got the hotel room, and we actually laid low. We were able to get a couple of rooms, and we found out, you know, there was an officer, he died, you know, and I was like, "Oh, man." So, I mean, we knew they were coming after us. We knew it. We had the short-term plan to escape from prison, but once getting out, it was very difficult. You know, we didn't have a long-term plan. We didn't know what to do. It's not like the books. It's not like the movies. You just don't run into people who are going to give you, you know, IDs or birth certificates to change your name. How do you do this? You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's not the movies. And so every day, it's, you know, you're constantly looking over your back.
Your childhood, I mean, your mother being hooked on heroin and not being capable of providing you the day-to-day care and even the emotional support that you needed. You know, you made amends with her?
Yes, I did. It was 1994, right before she died. She only had a couple of weeks left, and she had spent a week with me, and I took her all around the family members. You know, I know what she was doing. She was trying to make amends. You know, she was looking for forgiveness for everything that she had done. And, you know, most of my family member, her side of the family, were they didn't like her. You know, they because of the things she did. You know, she was hooked on heroin. She was stealing from the family. She abandoned all her kids. You know, and then to top it off, she abandoned Arlene, who had cancer. And so that was like a really bad, you know, mark for my mother. And but I took her around, and I remember putting her back on the bus. She didn't want to fly home. She wanted to see the scenery, and I put her on a Greyhound bus, and. I remember she turned around on the steps and she says, George, she goes, I just want to let you know you were always my favorite, you know. And I think for us at that moment, it was like, oh, I love you, Mom. You know, please forgive me for everything I've done. Because I was angry with her. You know, there was a lot of, you know, I always thought that she chose other men before me, you know.
And she did.
And she did, yeah. And so, but I think at that moment, at that time, you know, she was, I knew she was dying. You could see it. You know, I knew she didn't have much more time. And yeah, so I made my peace with her. And she died a week later.
But George, like right now, here you are. What about forgiveness? How does forgiveness enter into what's happening?
Man, I think about that, you know, I think about, you know, Aubrey's mother, I think about his dad, I think about his son, most of all, because I have a daughter myself. And
his wife?
His ex-wife, yes, of course. And, you know, for years I've thought, what would I say to him? You know, what could I tell him? You know, would anything I say to him give him any peace or take back, you know, what they've lost? And I don't think so, David. I don't, you know, they're hurting, you know? You know, you hear this phrase a lot, you know, we need closure. You know, killing me is not going to bring closure. You know, killing any of us on death row is not going to bring closure to anyone for the simple fact that you're always going to remember your loved one, whether it's a birthday or Christmas or holidays, if you celebrate the holidays, you know. That I think for me, closure is forgiveness, is when you start to learn how to heal, you know, when you actually forgive the person. I forgive you for what you've done. I've asked for forgiveness. I'll ask again. I'll keep asking. You know, I'm sorry. I wish this escape never happened. I wish I could take everything back because, you know, this wasn't supposed to happen at all. It was never planned for this. It was, I mean, it just...
What are we doing here? How did we end up here? How did you end up on that side of the glass and me on this side of the glass? And why isn't it the other way around?
David, bad luck, man. I'm just a bad shake at the law, you know. I mean, a lot of people are ignorant of the law in a sense, unless you're a part of it. You know, a lot of people will say, man, I really can't imagine what you're going through. And it's true, they can't, unless you're in the dead smack of it, you know, unless you're going through it yourself. And me personally, you know, I didn't know the law. You know, I knew certain things like, you know, hey, graduate from school, you know, get married, don't cheat on your wife, have kids and get a job and pay your taxes and get old and die. I mean, that's the extent, you know. I mean, don't speed, you know, the basic things. But getting into trouble such as, you know, where I was defending myself against Miguel, the intricacies of the trial itself, the court matter, the way they go about this, it's not about justice. I don't think it is. I think it's just about winning, especially on the state's part. I think it's just that, you know, with certain people, you know, if you have money, you can buy what you need to help you beat the system. Because really, that's all it is now. It's just a system, and I think it's a corrupt system. I think the judicial system that we're facing now, and it's just not me, because if it happens to me, it could happen to anybody.
But do you think you're just a guy who just had just bad luck throughout life?
Yeah, I've had a lot of bad luck, yeah. I think it was just, you know, I made some bad decisions. I made some bad decisions, you know what I'm saying? I don't, you know.
But, you know, you had made a bad decision to hang out with Luna that night and the girl,
yes,
and all that kind of,
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You should have stayed home with your uncle told,
exactly,
you.
Exactly.
But, you know, yeah, is that a decision that should have cost you so much?
Exactly. You know, and I always ask God that. You know, I've asked God for a long time, David, man, you know, why? You know, we walk so much. You know, man, what happened? The only thing I can think of, you know, is that I think God needed to get me to this point, because had I stayed out there in the free world, I probably wouldn't know God the way I know God now and the relationship that I have with him now.
I'm going to ask you about the process, you know, the pentobarbital, all the things. Are you, like, really up to speed on how that all, what they're going to do?
From what I heard from other guys who have gone through the process, you know, they said that when you get there to the walls, that the warden will talk to you, and he'll let you know the process of what's going to happen. You know, he says that they're pretty sincere up there. You know, they treat you with some respect, and as long as you're peaceful, they're peaceful, and the warden, you know, he tells you, hey, you don't want to see me no more, you know, because if you see me again, that means all your appeals have been, you know, processed through, and we're going to carry out the warden. And so it's not until that moment that they walk you over, and, you know, of course, they strap you in. And I've tried to visualize that, you know, and what it... I'm not scared to die, David. This whole process in which they strap you down to the table, it's almost like a crucifixion in a sense, you know, because the way they strap you down. And I think it's wrong, but I've had a tonsillectomy. I've had, you know, a hernia repair, and each time I've gone under anesthesia. I don't know if it's the same way. I don't know if that's just give you an overdose and you go to sleep, you know, and that's it. You just don't wake up anymore. I don't know. I don't know if he feels that. I don't know. The thought process, you know, they're putting you to, they're paralyzing you. It stops your lungs from breathing, so you're suffocating, you know. It doesn't stop your mind from thinking, you know, feeling the pain, because that's where your center is. That's where... you're feeling everything. I don't.
So
honestly, David, I haven't gotten that far yet. You know, it's an unknown to me, and I think I've gotten to the part where I've got to the cell. I visualized me getting to the cell and talking to my spiritual advisor, and maybe my attorney, but I haven't gotten any further than that. If it does go through, you know, I want to thank you, you know, for helping me, getting the people to know me. You know, I'm not that monster. I'm sorry. You know, I ask for forgiveness. I ask for mercy. Nobody wants to die, dude. You know, I do want to live.
Joseph Garcia is scheduled to be executed on December the 4th. He does have appeals, which are working their way through the system. There's also a challenge to the execution based on where Texas is getting the lethal injection drug from. There are reports that previous executed inmates have expressed pain and suffering, a burning that comes from the drug during its application. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us wherever you download those podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.